time. The silent herald of life and death, success or failure. The unseen force that measures man's destiny, reaching its most fateful moment as it slowly strikes the 11th hour.
The judge was bored, the jury listless. The courtroom, hot and airless that July afternoon, as the voice of the prosecutor droned on, reeling out Edward Brown's confession of murder. The defense had made no effort to keep that confession from being admitted as evidence. So the trial was as good as over. Eddie Brown would hang. In the press gallery, I hadn't bothered making shorthand notes. I'd heard Eddie's confession before. He had, in fact, made it first to me. In the dock, the prisoner betrayed no sign that he was soon to drop a bomb and turn his trial into one of the most sensational I'd ever witnessed. No, Eddie's handsome 23-year-old face showed nothing. He listened impassively as Mr. Cecil Pollock, Crown Prosecutor, read the statement he had so willingly signed.
Attention to this passage. The prisoner says, the Soho shop was untenanted. I had been engaged by the owners to repaint the front of the building. They had given me the keys so I could change inside and store my paint and ladders in the back room. I stopped work early and was standing in front of the shop, killing time and looking at the passers-by, when a girl came down the street. She was wearing a summer frock and carrying a large handbag. She stopped and looked me over carefully. Then she opened her handbag, took out a packet of American cigarettes, and came over to me.
Hiya, Buster.
Hi.
You got a match, or do I have to use my own?
Sorry. A match is in the back room, in my other clothes.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, what do you know? I haven't got a match in my purse at that.
Oh, if you wait a second, I'll get you one.
No hurry. That isn't why I stopped.
No?
No. Oh, look, I know this sounds kind of funny, but it isn't, see? I'm American. I've just been divorced. I got quite a nice little settlement out of the chump I was married to. And me and my girlfriend, Mabel, we decided to take a little trip.
Well,
we came to London, first on account of you people understand American, even if you don't speak it. Well, we've been sitting up in our hotel room for 3 days, and not one man has spoken to us or even given us the eye. I don't know whether we've got the plague or they're just stuck up.
Anyway,
I told Mabel I was sick of it. I was going out in the street and speak to the first good-looking man I saw and make him a proposition.
A proposition?
Oh, look, Buster, the kind of places we want to see in this town you can't get into without a man. Oh, we got plenty of dough. We'll pay for everything and give you something for your time. We want a guide, see? Well, how about it?
I don't know. Guide's one thing, a jiggler's another.
You're right, Buster. Make no mistake about it. What we want is a guide.
Yeah. Well, tell you what we'll do. Come inside. We'll have a cigarette and talk it over.
Oh, okay. Oh, gosh, it's kind of dark in here with a blind pulled.
All right. Give me a hand. I'll lead the way.
Maybe we should leave the door open.
Oh, don't be silly. Give me a hand.
In the following passage, the prisoner clearly states his motive. He says, while the girl, who subsequently identified herself as Juanita Bell, was rummaging in her purse for a match, I had seen a large roll of banknotes. In the back room, I tried to take the purse from her. She struggled and began to scream. I put my hands around her throat in an effort to silence her. I lost control and forgot the strength of my hands. The next thing I remember, she was lying slumped on the floor, dead. I ran out of the shop. I was so agitated by what I had done that I forgot to lock the door. Later, I threw the key into the Thames. I wandered around aimlessly, trying to think what to do. Finally, I went back to my rooming house and hurriedly began to pack, intending to run away. There was a knock at the door. I was half out of my mind with fear.
Who's there?
Inspector Clark, Scotland Yard. I'd like to talk to you, Mr. Brown.
Just a minute. I'm shaving.
Going somewhere, Mr. Brown?
Why, no. I'm unpacking, as a matter of fact. Not going anywhere.
Oh, but you are, Mr. Brown. We'd like to have a word with you down at the yard. I understand you have the keys to a vacant shop in Soho.
Keys? Why, I did have them. I don't have them now. I gave them to a chap late this afternoon.
Oh? Who was this chap?
Well, he said he was a prospective tenant. Said he just wanted to look round. And the owners had told him to get the keys from me. I gave them to him and left before he did.
Can you describe this man?
Oh, he was just a man. Medium height, ordinary sort of face. Nothing very special about him.
I see. You can't tell us anything that would help us to identify him.
Yes. He was wearing a leather coat. A long leather coat like German officers wore.
I doubt that'll help us very much. A lot of soldiers brought those back from Germany after the war.
Oh, yes, I suppose they did.
Would you recognize this man again?
Yes, I think so.
Well, now, suppose you'll come along with me, Mr. Brown.
What for?
Just to help us, a little information and so forth. Good morning, Mr. Brown. Sleep well?
No, I didn't. You had no right to keep me here all night.
Sorry, but we thought it was necessary. Now, this shouldn't take very long. All right, Sergeant. You can start the men through the lineup now.
Walk out of the platform and stand facing the inspector. Turn sideways, showing your profile. Then go off the other side. All right, let's go now.
Look closely now. See if you recognize the man you gave the key to.
All right, Inspector.
You have no right to put me in a lineup. I haven't done anything.
That's him. That's the man in the leather coat.
What have I done? Who are you? What are you accusing me of?
That's the man I gave the key to. He killed her, Inspector. He killed her.
The prisoner's confession continues as follows. When the man I had falsely identified as the one to whom I had given the key was able to prove his whereabouts at the time of the murder, the inspector again turned his attention to me. Again and again I was questioned, but I stuck to my original statement that I had given my key to a man in a leather coat. After several days, I was released, for the police could not prove enough against me to bring me to trial. Over the next 2 years, I brooded about what I had done. In November of 1948, I went to the offices of a large London newspaper and asked to see Mr. Kent Rogers, the court reporter. I had often read his accounts of trials in the press.
Mr. Rogers?
Yes. What's on your mind?
I want to confess to a murder.
You... Would you mind saying that again?
2 years ago, I strangled an American girl named Juanita Bell. The police couldn't prove I did it, so they released me.
Mr. Bell, if you're some kind of a crank trying to get publicity...
I'm not a crank. I can tell you exactly how I did it. Everything.
Yes, well, why tell me? Why don't you go to the police?
I like the way you write up trials in the newspaper. Got a nice style. Anyway, why are you complaining? It's a scoop for you, isn't it?
Yes, yes. If it's true.
It's true, all right. Besides, I got another reason for telling you.
What reason?
Never mind. You just take down what I say. Then you can check with Inspector Clark at Scotland Yard. He handled the case before.
Millard, gentlemen of the jury. The prisoner, Edward Brown, stands convicted of murder out of his own mouth by his own voluntary statement. Therefore, the Crown need present no further evidence. And on these words, his own words, the Crown rests its case. Thank you.
Is counsel for the defence now ready to present his case?
Yes, my lord.
You may proceed, Mr. Sands.
Thank you. Gentlemen of the jury, in order to save the court's time, I will waive the customary opening remarks usually made by defense counsel. I will call my first and only witness, the defendant, Edward Brown.
We were surprised that the defense had decided to call the prisoner. There was a stir of interest in the court, but no sympathy crossed the faces of the jurors as Eddie Brown took the stand.
And now then, Mr. Brown, you have heard the statement read out in this court.
I have.
Is it the truth?
It's an absolute lie. Silence in court.
Mr. Brown, do I understand that you repudiate your confession?
No, my lad. I said those things and signed my name to them, but they're all lies. I never saw Juanita Bell in my life. I gave the key to the shop to the man in the leather coat, just as I told the inspector at first.
You may proceed with your examination, Mr. Sands.
Thank you, my lad. Your confession is entirely false.
It is.
Yet you voluntarily made the statement to the police, and you made the same statement to the court reporter, Kent Rogers.
I did.
I see. Then tell me, why did you go to Rogers' office at the newspaper and tell him this story if it were not true?
For 2 years, I lived under suspicion. No one would employ me. My friends wouldn't associate with me. Yet no charge had ever been laid against me. Therefore, I had no hope of ever clearing my name. I decided to confess so that I'd have to be brought to trial. That's why I told Mr. Rogers this story. That's why I'm here. To clear my name.
Mr. Pollock.
Yes, sir.
In your closing remarks to the court, I understood you to say that you intend to offer no evidence other than the prisoner's confession. Is that correct?
Yes, lad.
I see. Gentlemen of the jury, it is obvious that the defendant is a liar. But it is, of course, equally obvious that he cannot be convicted because of it.
Edward Brown, a self-confessed murderer, left the court a free man. The case of the curious confession would have ended up another of London's unsolved crimes, except for a strange course of events in which I was again to figure in my capacity as court reporter. It was almost 2 years later that I dropped into Scotland Yard late one afternoon to call on Inspector Clark.
Well, Rogers, haven't seen you for several weeks.
You haven't been in court lately?
No, I haven't. The way things are going, I may never get my present case to court. What's on your mind?
Yeah, well, I'm doing a spot of crime reporting at the moment.
Yeah, they say a change is as good as a holiday.
Well, I go a bit stale on court reporting. I like to get out among my raw material occasionally, see the people I write about before they appear in court. I'm covering the case you're working on now, the Silk Stocking murder.
You press chaps glamorize everything, sir. That stocking wasn't silk. It was lisle. And the murdered woman was not young and beautiful as she was written up. She was over 40. And she looked it.
Yes. We do color the facts a little sometimes. After all, a lisle stocking suggests, a housemaid. We couldn't call the case that, the lisle stocking murder. It's not, euphonious, more glamorous.
Mm. You know the details, I suppose?
No, more or less, yes. But I'd like to hear them from you, just for the record.
Mary Sutton, bookkeeper, unmarried, had a basement flat in Victoria. During the night, somebody entered her flat with the intention of robbing her. She was in bed. She evidently awakened. The burglar grabbed the first thing handy, her stocking, and then strangled her with it. He then took what money he could find and left the flat. She was discovered the next morning by neighbors who had heard nothing at all during the night.
Any clues?
None. Sometimes, though, you get a break in the sort of case. At least, that's what I've been telling myself. Come in.
There's a young woman outside who wants to see you, Inspector.
What about?
An RAF deserter.
Well, can't you handle it, Sergeant?
Well, yes, sir, but she's read about you in the paper, and she says talking to you will be more like talking to someone she knows.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
The penalty of fame, eh?
And who's responsible? You reporters. All right, Sergeant. Send her in.
Yes, sir. You want me to step outside?
No, you can stay. I'll just have a word with her, then I'll pass her on to the sergeant.
You can go right in, Miss Caulfield.
Thank you.
Come in, miss.
Thank you. I'm Laura Caulfield, Inspector.
How do you do? This is Mr. Rogers.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Please sit down. Now then, miss, what's troubling you?
Well, it's about me young man. Or rather, he was me young man up until a few weeks ago. He had a few too many at the pub one evening, and he told me he was a deserter from the RAF. Well, naturally, I refused to see him after that. But he kept coming round and, well, threatening me. Well, I don't like it about his being a deserter, but I wouldn't put him in. I mean, I hate doing a thing like this. Only, you see, I'm afraid.
Afraid? Afraid of what?
Well, every night he comes and stands across the street and watches me window. If I go out, he stops me and we argue. Last night he was really wild. He hinted that he'd taken care of other girls who tried to throw him over and... Well, I'm afraid of him. I really am.
Yeah. Well, you're perfectly right in coming along to us. In fact, it'd be wrong of you if you hadn't come. Could have meant trouble for you.
That's what I thought.
You just go outside, tell all this to the sergeant, will you? Give me your name and address, and he'll arrange to have the young man picked up.
Oh, yes, sir. Look, I brought this along so you'd know him when you see him. It's a snap we had taken right after we first met. Here it is.
Oh, thank you. This will be quite a big help to us. Rogers.
Eh? Oh, yes, Inspector.
Take a look at this. Do you recognize him?
He does look a bit familiar, yes, but... No, can't say that I do.
When you last saw him, he had no moustache, and he looked much younger. He had very much longer hair, not short cropped like this.
Yes, of course.
Inspector...
Now, you just run along, miss, and tell the sergeant all about it. We'll take care of everything.
Oh, well, all right, Inspector. Thanks very much.
Miss, will you ask the sergeant just to step in here for a moment?
Yes, sir.
See, that's a photo of Eddie Brown.
That's him, all right.
I always wondered what happened to him.
A young lady says you want to see me, then.
Yes, keep her here while I go out and pick up a boyfriend.
But I thought you weren't going to handle it.
I've changed my mind. Have a car sent round. I shall be leaving at once.
All right, Inspector.
I'd like to go with you to pick him up.
I'm sure you would. Unfortunately, regulations won't quite permit that. Drop round in the morning. I'll let you have the story then. It'll be interesting to see Eddie Brown again.
Inspector. The sergeant tells me you picked up Brown last night.
He certainly did.
Anything in it for me?
One of the best stories you've ever struck. But you can't print it.
Oh. You might not, hmm?
Eddie Brown confessed to the silk stocking murder.
He what?
You heard me. He confessed to the murder of Mary Sutton. Just like he did in the Juanita Bell case.
I say, this is getting a bit of a habit, isn't
it? You can say that again. His case beginning to follow an all too familiar pattern. He got away with it once, and he might do so again.
You don't mean it.
I'm afraid I do. You can't print that he's been tried for murder before, nor can that fact be introduced as evidence at his trial.
No, that's true.
It's a fundamental tenet of British law. The jury can't be told of a defendant's previous conviction or trial.
Let me see him, Inspector. Maybe I can...
Yeah, you'll see him, all right. You'll see him in court.
And so, incredible as it seems, I again took my place in the press gallery and looked down at Edward Brown, for the second time a prisoner in the dock. As the Crown Prosecutor read out Brown's confession, only three people in the courtroom realized that his earlier trial was being reenacted in an amazing fashion. So changed was Brown's appearance that few had recognized him, and so common was the name that it had gone, well, I'd say unnoticed. But fate had decreed another remarkable coincidence. The Crown Prosecutor who rose to read out his confession was the same who had faced him before, Mr. Cecil Pollock. His presence in court must have given the defendant a shock.
Continues as follows.
Mr. Pollock paused, took a sip of water, and continued reading Brown's statement.
For several weeks I had been hiding out during the day in a basement cupboard across from Mary Sutton's flat. The door of the building was never locked, and I was able to go in and out at will. On the night of October the 7th, I entered Mary Sutton's flat. She was asleep, but in the light of a street lamp outside, I could see her purse lying on a table beside her bed. I crept over and was about to take the purse when she awakened and began to scream. We struggled. Somehow, I managed to get a stocking round her throat. I choked her with that. Then I took the money in her purse and left the flat. 3 days later, I was arrested by the police as a deserter from the RAF, at which time I made this voluntary statement. Signed, Edward Brown.
Step by step, the trial progressed with its incredibly familiar pattern. As his first witness, the prisoner's counsel, Mr. R.G. Williams, called Edward Brown to the stand.
You have heard your statement read out by the learned prosecutor?
I have.
Is there any comment you wish to make on it?
Yes. I did not kill Mary Sutton.
Does counsel for the defense intend to claim that the confession was expected under duress?
No, my lad. We claim that for reasons which the defendant will explain, he did not tell the truth in his statement.
If the Crown wishes to move for an adjournment, I will hear such a motion.
The Crown does not require an adjournment, my lad. We are prepared this time.
My lad, I object. I move the prosecutor's final remark be deleted from the record.
I withdraw the remark, my lad.
If the jury will disregard the prosecutor's remark, we are prepared this time. Counsel for the defense may proceed with examination.
Mr. Brown, do you deny all of your statement to the police?
No, sir. I am a deserter from the RAF. I did enter the Sutton flat on the night of the murder, but I did it because I heard a struggle inside. Then a man ran out of the door and ran up the steps. I went in to see what was wrong. I found her dead. I was about to leave when suddenly I decided to confess to the murder.
Why?
I was despondent. I didn't want to go on living. I was a deserter. Couldn't find a job. I was desperately in love with my girl, Laura Caulfield. And she had thrown me over. Sooner or later, I knew I'd be caught and probably convicted of the Sutton murder anyway. Who'd believe I hadn't done it? And when my girlfriend turned me into the police, I confessed to a murder I did not commit.
No more questions, my lad.
You may proceed with cross-examination, Mr. Pollock.
Thank you, my lad. Mr. Brown, you wished to confess to a murder you did not commit.
Yes, sir.
You decided that while you were in the room?
Yes, sir.
I see. If you wished to confess, why didn't you go directly to the police and do so?
Well, I guess I decided later.
That is not what you said a moment ago.
Now that I think it over, I decided later, yes.
I see. Did you touch the body?
No, sir.
Did you touch the stocking?
No, sir.
But you saw it in the light thrown by the street lamp outside.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Brown, will you describe the stocking?
It was just an ordinary Lyle stocking, nothing special about it.
An ordinary Lyle stocking?
Yes.
Mr. Brown, are you aware that in all newspaper accounts of this case, it has been referred to as the silk stocking murder? You could not possibly know it was Lyle unless you had committed the murder yourself.
No, I read it somewhere.
Why, I heard... I submit that your entire confession is true. That you murdered Mary Sutton exactly as you said you did. That you are guilty. Guilty of murder as charged.
The jury was out 40 minutes. Then they returned a verdict of guilty. The man who confessed once too often was convicted and later hanged. What curious compulsion made Edward Brown confess him? Evidently some twisted bravado drove him to crave center stage in the drama of the courtroom. Though it took 5 years and 2 trials to accomplish it, justice was finally done, and Edward Brown paid for his crimes with his life.
In his case, there was no reprieve at the 11th hour.
Listening for another mounting drama of action and suspense when we again bring you the 11th hour. The Case of the Curious Confession was written by Philip Albright and produced by Jim Bradley for our transit.